Welcome to the Old Time Radio Westerns. I'm your host, Andrew Rines, and this episode is brought to you by Edwards Heritage Consulting. Edwards Heritage Consulting focuses on helping you discover your heritage and roots and is passionate about family, heritage architecture, and genealogy. For more information, contact Helen by email, heritagelady@gmail.com. Again, that's heritagelady@gmail.com. Let her know you found her from OTR Westerns. Let's get into this episode. This episode's going to be Gunsmoke. Original air date. This comes from about 1976, April. I think it's April 26th, 1976. There's no exact date, but the research we've done does say April 26th, 1976. This is the story of Gunsmoke, part four. This is second to last. One more after this one. And I hope you guys have been enjoying. And let's get into it. Thanks again for listening.
It was released twice a week. It would be released first on a Sunday night and then re-released the following Saturday morning. We had a tremendous audience. As I recall, I think we were something like, because of the double show, we had an audience of something like 50 million people every week, which was fantastic. You know,
Gunsmoke got its share of fan mail, no more nor less than other shows that were on the air at that time. We tried to answer our fan mail. We had special letterheads printed up in period style saying, Office of the Marshal, 1871, Dodge City, Kansas. And at the bottom it said, For Marshal Dillon, by, and then I would sign my name, and everybody was satisfied. We tried to answer it all, and I think that's good public relations.
Chester got fan mail that generally showed some irritation. Wanting to know why he had behaved like that. Or why hadn't he used a little sense, you know. People were always wanting to do Chester over, which was kind of remarkable. The letters that came were advising me to shape up or ship out. Bill got a lot of letters for the magnificence of his portrayal. I never got any unfriendly letters. But you got the feeling that some of these people would shake me good if they got a chance.
There was one letter that I can still remember, addressed to John Nesta, and came from Texas, from a fan named Effie. And she had some particular ideas about what should be done next. And we'll let John tell you this.
Well, this is a letter, fan letter I got. The only one I ever got. From Rogers, Texas, September 1953. It was addressed to me. And inside, there's no date or anything. It's from a woman called Effie, and I won't use her last name, it's an ordinary name. The letter reads very simply, Oh, John, you have to come home. Stick your toes to this fire. I've just been wondering about you in this cold. Ma, am I hungry? I want supper. Been down in the timber rolling them logs. How about the kids? Done fed them, baked their toes, put them to bed. Have to milk them cows. Seen them hens laid. Feed that old mule. Well, I guess that all. Oh, my back. What's wrong with you, John? Thinking about that hard day tomorrow, honey? Honey, you got to work to make them kids something to eat. Oh, my back. Got to see a doctor, get some pills. Oh, John, you just got nerves. You will be all right. Them children can't eat rabbits to live. Signed, Effie. My favorite fan, whoever she is. Great, lovely lady.
5 or 6 years after we had been on the air, I have parked my car and I'm walking across the parking lot to go into CBS to do another set of two. And a guy walks up to me and he says, Mr. Conrad? And I said, yes. He said, boy, I just think that you're fantastic. It's a great show, Gunsmoke, and the way you play Matt Dillon is just absolutely super, and I think you're great. would you do me a great favor? And I said, well, sure, if I can, certainly. He said, would you do the opening for me? And I looked at him and I said, the what? He said, the opening. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I really don't know what you mean. And he said, the opening to Gunsmoke, the thing you say every Saturday or Sunday night when you open the show. I said, gee, are you not thinking of another show maybe? Because I really don't remember. And he said, oh, okay, fine. You're a big star, huh? Well, fine. Thank you very much for being so courteous to me. And he turns furious and walks away from me. And I still didn't know what it was. And I walked into the rehearsal and I said, hey, the funniest thing happened to me. And I related the story. And they said, oh, God, it's the opening. I said, what opening? They said, you recorded it 7 years ago and you haven't done it since.
When Gunsmoke went on the air in April of 52, it was really the only one of its kind. In the years that followed, I think there were a good many imitators, some very successful and some just poor imitations. Shows not only went from radio to television, but a couple of shows came from television to radio. For example, Have Gun Will Travel, which was on adjacent to the television program of Gunsmoke, became a radio program after the fact, several years later, and was quite successful. John Daner played the lead. He played Paladin, the part that Dick Boone originated.
We never really went into depth about Paladin, except that he sort of came out of nowhere. He was the Robin Hood. He was the man who could do no wrong. He righted all evils and protected the poor from the depredations of the wealthy and so forth. He was a rather one-dimensional character, if you want my honest opinion about Paladin. And even on the television show, it was it had that aspect to it, unlike Gunsmoke, where the characters seemed to be more real. There was fantasy in Paladin, you see. But that didn't take away from the fact that it was a lot of fun to do.
Then there were other shows that were in this general area of Western or period. One of them that I was connected with was Fort Laramie, starring Raymond Burr. It was a cavalry show, again, 1870 or 1875, in Wyoming, and a successful one. John Daner starred in another radio show called Frontier Gentleman.
That was the brainchild of Tommy Ellis. He was a writer. He wrote a lot of escapes and romances, and he just got the idea that there should be a civilized individual showing up in the West and the adventures that befall him, thinking mainly of the English remittance man who is sent over to this country by his family in England because they don't quite know what to do with him, but he's better off out of sight. Sure, they'll send him his monthly stipend to keep him going, but as long as he doesn't bother them, that's what they're after. So he shows up in the United States and goes west. And this was, by the way, quite common in the West in those days, you know. The remittance man idea was quite worldwide, where the English would send their men off to the colonies, their unwanted scions. But the English man was a great force in the development of the West. And Frontier Gentleman was based more or less upon that idea.
The radio show had been on the air about a year when it became apparent it was a fairly solid operation. It also was apparent in those days that television was looming large. So Meston and I talked to the radio executives about was there a way to move it to television, and indeed they'd already been thinking about this, and it was in the works. So Meston and I were convinced that we'd be producing and writing the television series, which, as it turned out, we were not, which was probably a very good thing. They hired a novelist and a motion picture producer-director named Charles Marquis Warren to come in and get the television series organized, and I was allowed to come in as an associate producer, which I must admit, I was very pleased to do. Then came the matter of course, the cast, once it had been determined to go ahead with the television version. And it seemed obvious to me that it should be Bill Conrad, Howard McNair, Parley Bear, and Georgia Ellis, because they'd created the parts, and they were indeed Matt and Doc and Kitty and Chester. But I didn't know enough to know that it didn't always work that smoothly. The determination was made to test several people for these several parts, and it looked for a while as though the Gunsmoke radio cast wasn't even going to be considered or tested. There was a Los Angeles newspaper man named Hal Humphreys who was a great fan of the radio show and a great fan of the people and the actors. And he petitioned and lobbied in his Los Angeles Times column day after day, and I think was largely responsible in securing for the radio cast an audition. We taped in Studio 43, I think it was, at TV City. It was all right. It wasn't staggering. It was all right, but I don't think anybody upstairs even saw it, because it was purely a token audition so that the radio people would keep on working in radio, and which they did for another 7 years. It was determined to go with Jim Arness, who was a protege of Duke Wayne's and a good actor, although a newcomer, and Dennis Weaver and Amanda Blake and Milburn Stone, all good, solid actors. Bill Warren really should get a tremendous amount of credit for transcribing or transferring the shows from radio to television. I think he was able to keep in his production and direction of the first script, which was a Meston television script, in being able to keep the feel and the intent of what the radio show had been. It was Bill who wardrobed the principals, and for many years they were the only well-wardrobed westerns on the air. Bill was responsible for the kind of photography and the kind of sets. I was able to be of considerable help, I hope, by being able to describe how we had pictured the sets and how we had pictured the Long Branch and the street and where the jail cells were and all the other things that we'd worked with in radio.
When the transition was made to television, the first any of us in radio knew about it was when we read it in the trade papers. We were a little disgruntled that we hadn't been considered right for the parts. It's a little nonplussing to be told that you're not right for something that you had created, but that happens all the time.
The character transferred to television was generally faithful, except in the case of Chester, played on radio by Parley Bear. CBS officials started by changing Chester's last name from Proudfoot to Good.
And when they made the transition, I was told that one of the officials with CBS said he'd better change his name because Parley might have cause to for plagiarism suit. And I saw this man in the lobby of the station one day, and I said, I trust CBS, even though CBS doesn't apparently trust me. And I said, and I have less cause to trust CBS, and CBS has to trust me. And that is, I got the story that they changed his name because they were afraid I would kick up a fuss. What I should really have kicked up a fuss about, as well as Bill and Howard and everybody else, is for the first 156 shows, they used radio scripts for the television thing almost in toto. And it was a little irritating to hear lines that you had written, hear your own ad-libs incorporated into the television series. But why joust with windmills, you know? We didn't get it, and those fellows did a good job. I think Jim Arness as Dylan became sort of a pillar on the national scene, and I'm not taking away from him anything that he did in his performance or in painting the character, because he had 20 years of great success. But my opinion is this: I do think Bill would have been better.
Dennis Weaver's television portrayal of Chester was different too.
Dennis played him as a younger man, and I always considered Chester sort of ageless. If somebody had said to me, how old is Chester, as you claim, I'd honestly say, I don't know. He could have been anywhere from 30 to 50. Chester was certainly no romancer. he was embarrassed by ladies, and though he had his moments, they never quite came to fruition. Even with Kitty, to Chester, it was always Miss Kitty. He was unusual for those times. It was quick to rise when a lady came in, and he had little or no contact with women in those days. They didn't marry the likes of Chester because he was sort of on the outside looking in, and of course there was always a scarcity of women in Dodge City and those cow towns along hill, and the marriageable ones were already married, or the ones who had a future for marriage were very zealously guarded, and they were always looking for someone with more money to come along than Chester had. But we played him differently. Someone said, "Did Chester limp on radio?" And I said, "No." Now, how true this story is, I don't know. I've heard it repeated many times that Chester was given a limp on his character for TV because he was coming on pretty strong as a romantic figure, and they felt that if Dennis played him, Dennis, a very handsome man, they felt he was overshadowing the character of Dylan. And so they gave him some physical handicap. I don't think it was necessary, but again, who am I to fight with success? Dennis was very successful as Chester for a great many years.
The television show was bought quickly from the pilot film that Bill Warren made and went on the air in September of 55, and was almost immediately well received. Part of this, of course, was that there had been 3 years of pre-publicity because the Gunsmoke radio show had been enormously well received in those 3 years prior, so it was a happy wedding. Bill produced and directed the first 26 shows, and I think a combination of fatigue and pressure and just the weight of carrying that big a job all by himself made it difficult to continue, and he left after 26 weeks to do a feature. When Bill left, I was able and lucky enough to slip into the mantle of producer of the series, not attempting to direct any. So I stayed with the show as producer from the 27th show through the next 9 years, and left the series in 1964.
We'll return to the biography of Gunsmoke in just one moment. Here again is John Hickman.
By 1957, much of John Meston's time was devoted to writing the television series. Other writers were called upon for the radio scripts. Again, Norman McDonald.
One of the other people that wrote for us was Les Crutchfield. I first came to know Les when he was still working at Caltech as an engineer. But at that time, which must have been 46 or 47, he came in to see Bill Robeson with a script for a Columbia workshop, which Bill bought, and Les was on his way toward being a very successful writer. Les worked with me later on Escape and on Romance and a number of shows. And when we did start Gunsmoke, it just was obvious that Les would have to be part of the family, which indeed he was. He wrote not as many as Meston, but more perhaps than any other single writer. Les was a warm and very funny and very charming man. He was his own man, and he did what he wanted when he wanted. So if you needed him desperately to do a script, he might be available, or he might have been on his way to Africa, and you really never knew. But when he was in town, he wrote well, and he was dependable. Perhaps Les did more of the light or of the comedy shows than John Meston. One in particular that I always enjoyed was a script called Colleen So Green, in which this attractive girl comes to town and completely befuddles Doc and Chester and everybody else in town, including Mr. Botkin at the bank. But one of Les's scripts that I remember particularly, and perhaps personifies the kind of writing that made him such a valuable piece of manpower for Gunsmoke, was a script that he wrote called Tag You're It.
I Chester.
Chester!
Was you saying something, Mr. Dillon?
What is that?
Oh, this is a duck call. I ordered all the way from St. Louis. It just come in the mail.
Doesn't sound like any duck I ever heard.
Oh, it's guaranteed, Mr. Dillon. See, any duck that hears this comes right at you.
You better be careful. We don't want the jail overrun with them.
Oh, well, they ain't none around yet, but they just about do. When they start coming through, I'm going to get down there in them bushes along the river with a shotgun and this thing. And, Mr. Dillon, we're going to be eating roast duck every day for 3 months.
I'm glad to hear that, Chester.
Takes kind of a knack to bone.
Uh-huh.
It takes a little bit of practice, and I ain't got it down exact yet, but I will.
Gentlemen.
Come in, mister.
You're Marshal Dillon?
Yeah, that's right.
I am Cyrus Taggart, Marshal. Possibly you've heard of me.
I'm afraid not, but what can I do for you, Mr. Taggart?
You can give me your complete cooperation.
Oh?
I have here a photograph of a young lady. I have reason to believe she is in Dodge City.
Why, Mr. Dillon, that's...
Go on, Mr. Taggart. Suppose she is here.
She's my daughter, Evie Taggart. She ran away from home nearly a year ago, and she has made it very difficult to find her.
And if you do find her?
I shall take her back to New York with me, naturally. I assume from your partner's exclamation that you do know her.
Not by that name.
Yes. Well, she has used a number of false names during the past year. Very well, you will take me to her at once.
How old is your daughter, Mr. Taggart?
24.
And then she's of legal age. Suppose she won't go back with you.
Marshal, the Taggart enterprises include railroads, several banks and finance companies, along with mining and cattle interests. I, with my father and my grandfather before me, did not acquire them by tolerating interference with our wishes.
Now, why did she run away in the first place?
Because she's a willful, headstrong little fool. Marshal, we're wasting time.
Mr. Taggart, I'm not going to take you to her. Not just yet.
May I remind you...
Your enterprises, sir, don't include the United States Marshal's Office.
I imagine my influence could extend that far, if you compel me to use it.
You do as you like. But I'm going to talk to the girl first. I'm going to find out what she wants to do.
What she wants is of no importance.
Good day, Mr. Taggart.
She keeps pretty late hours, Mr. Dillon. Maybe she ain't up yet.
Yeah, maybe not.
Hello, Marshal. Chester.
Morning, Patsy. Or, I guess it's Evie Taggart now, isn't it?
Oh. He's here, huh?
Mm-hmm. Over at the Dodge House. He says he's come to take you home.
It's all right, girl. Come on in.
No, thank you.
Wouldn't do any good to run. Not now.
I thought I heard you talking to some... No.
You know Burl Alden, don't you, Marshal?
Yeah, you deal blackjack, don't you, over the Golden Horn part-time?
That's right. What's the trouble, Marshal?
My father's here, Burl. Finally caught up with me.
Well, what of it? You're over 21. He can't do nothing.
You don't know him.
What can he do, Marshal? She's got a right to live her life the way she wants, ain't she?
Yeah, as far as the law's concerned, he may try other ways.
He will. He'll do anything. I know him.
He'll be sorry if he tries anything. I'll stick with you. You know that.
I know, Burl. But I know how he can be. That's why I never wanted him to find me.
Are you sure that you don't want to go back with him, Evie?
Of course I'm sure.
It's a rough life you're leading here, working in a long branch, having to put up with any man who comes along who's got the price of a drink.
Anything would be better than going back home. You don't know what it was like, Marshal. I don't really matter to him. I never did. It's just a family name he cares about. He's afraid I'll disgrace it. I'm not going back.
Now he says you are, Evie. And I'd say he's used to getting his own way.
No matter what I have to do, I'm not going back. No matter what.
Thank you. Sam, the men back at the faro table want another round when you get a chance.
All right, Kitty.
Let Margie take it back to him, huh?
Okay. Hello, Kitty.
Oh, Matt, I didn't see you come in.
Well, you look busy, so I kept quiet.
You know, I just assumed you hadn't come in tonight, Matt.
Oh? Well, I can always have a beer up the street.
No, it's just that I did something this evening that I hate myself for.
Yeah? Well, what do you mean?
Come on, let's sit down.
All right. There you are. Well, what's it all about?
Well, that girl, Patsy, who's been working here the last few months. You know who she is, Matt?
Yeah. Her name's Evie Taggart. Her father came out from the East yesterday.
Yeah, I know. I met him. You know he's trying to force her to go back to New York with him?
Uh-huh.
Well, he didn't waste any time going into action. He just sent a few telegrams east, and that did it.
Oh, did what?
Well, Mr. Botkin came over from the bank this afternoon. He was real apologetic, but he had orders from the big bank back east that holds part of his stock.
Oh, one of Taggart's banks.
Yeah. Either I fired Evie or Botkin had called in our loan. And just a half hour later, I got a telegram from our wholesaler in Kansas City. Fire Evie or pay up all our consignment accounts immediately. I let it go, Matt. I had to.
You couldn't do much of anything else, could you?
I got my partner to think about. The girls. You can't fight an army barehanded.
There's no reason to feel guilty, Kitty. You didn't have much choice.
Well, I don't claim the life she's leading here is very good. Good or bad, at least what she wants to do, and she ought to have the right.
You know, rights are pretty hard things to hang on to sometimes.
Well, if there'd been any other way.
Oh, here you are.
What?
Oh, he scared you off, huh? You started the ball rolling, now nobody will hire you.
Take it easy, Burl.
Well, whose side are you on anyway, Marshal?
There's no law against what Taggart did, Burl, and Kitty didn't have any choice. She had to go along with it.
The word's out all over town. Nobody will give her a job. They're afraid of his money.
Well, I got reason to be.
He's trying to starve her out. He thinks he'll get her back home that way.
Well, it's worked before.
Well, it won't this time. We'll figure some way to beat that old buzzard.
Why don't you support her, Mr. Alden? I assume you are Burl Alden.
I guess you're Taggart. Hmm?
That's correct. As I said, why don't you support her? I understand she's been supporting you for several months.
That's a lie. I got a job.
Yes, yes, part-time. But you've been taking money from her, haven't you?
Them was loans. What are you getting at, anyway?
The fact that you're an utterly worthless loafer who lives off the earnings of a woman.
Why, you dirty old...
All right, hold it, Burl. That's enough.
No. Who do you think he's talking to?
Can I give you a hand, Mr. Taggart?
No, thank you. It would seem to me that it's your job to prevent such occurrences, Marshal.
You can sign a complaint if you like.
No, thank you. I have something rather more drastic in mind. Good evening, gentlemen.
That's a cold fish.
What's he talking about, Marshal? He can't do nothing to me.
I wouldn't bet on that, Burl.
Good morning, Matt.
Oh, hello. Hello, Don. Come on in.
Oh, Chester, for heaven's sake, put that thing away.
Yeah, there's some coffee on the top of the stove. I don't guarantee it, though. Our duck made it.
Well, then I pass.
Well, you drunk it plenty of times before, and it never hurts you none, Doc.
Well, a man's luck runs out, Chester. Let's
pull up a chair, Doc.
No. Haven't got time, Matt. I don't have a plush-lined seat at the public trough. Like some people I know.
Oh, is that so?
A professional man like myself has to get out and scramble if he wants to keep body and soul together.
Doc, the only time I ever seen you scramble is when Sam Noonan says, have one on the house, boys.
Oh, is that so? For 2 cents, I wouldn't even tell you what I know.
All right, what do you know, Doc?
Oh, yes, now, you got your ears off, ain't you? Yeah, you're starting to sing a different tune now.
Doc.
It's a fine thing when I have to do your job alone with my own. Just out of the kindness of my heart.
Doc.
There's going to be a killing.
Killing? How do you know?
Because I keep my mouth shut and my ears open. You know a gunman named Bill Jackson?
Yeah, he's been around town for a month or so. Why?
Well, they say that old man Taggart's hired him to kill Burl Alden.
Yeah.
So that's what Taggart meant about something more drastic.
Yes. But anyway, I've done all the brain work for you. Now, go on out and arrest them.
On what charge, Doc? They'll both deny it.
Well, you're just going to sit there and let it happen, are you?
And I'll listen to suggestions, Doc, but in the long run, it'll probably come to just that. Matt Dillon, let me in.
Evie ain't here, Marshal. She went down to the Chinaman's to bring some grub.
Now, you're the one I want to see, Burl.
All right. Come on in. What is it? What do you want?
Burl, you made a bad enemy when you knocked old man Taggart down.
I'll knock him down 7 days a week if he don't stay away from us.
Oh, he'll stay away, all right. But the man he's hired to kill you won't.
What are you talking about?
Well, the word's out that he's offered Bill Jacks $2,000 to put you on Boot Hill.
Well, you got to do something, Marshal. I know about Jacks. You got to arrest him.
I got no proof, Burl. All I can do is warn you.
Well, then I got to get out of here. I got to get out of town right now. I'll get a horse from Moss Grimmick and head south.
Well, what about Evie?
Evie? Well, she'd be better off back home anyway.
Oh, I see.
Well, hitting the trail on the run, that ain't no kind of a life for a woman.
You think the Long Branch is any better?
Now, you got no call to talk like that.
What's going on?
Evie, you tell her, Marshal.
Burl, where you going? Burl!
So you see, he's gone.
Gone where? What do you mean?
Hey, your father hired a gunman to kill him.
So Burl's getting out. Running away, leaving me.
Well, I guess a lot of men would act that same way under the circumstances.
Try to make excuses for him, Marshal. I know the kind he is. I've known all along.
No?
The life I've been living the last year isn't a very pretty one. And I admit it. I guess I've done it on purpose. Sunk as low as I could. It was a way of hitting back at my father.
Yeah, it works that way sometimes.
Wasn't a very pretty life at home either, Marshal.
No, I guess not. Kirk wouldn't have turned you to this.
I'd kill her. At least I'll get that stopped. Burl doesn't deserve dying. He's just what he is, and that's all he claims to be. There's no reason he should pay. But my father's going to. I'm going to see that he pays.
Pays how?
I don't know exactly. But he's going to. He's going to pay for things once and for all.
Oh, don't look to me like neither one of them ain't going to show up, Mr. Dillon.
They might not, Chester. All I know is Taggart bought 2 tickets back east on this afternoon's train.
I swear I never thought Evie'd give in and go back with him.
Well, he's a hard man to beat.
It's just a doggone shame the way he goes around treating people and gets by with it.
He won't get by with it forever, Chester. If you keep pushing people around, sooner or later, you're going to push one of them a little too far.
Uh-oh. Speak of the devil, Mr. Dillon.
Yeah. And by himself, too.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Nice of you to drop around to see us off.
Us, Mr. Taggart?
Oh, my daughter is just looking after some detail of her luggage. She'll be along. Much as I hate to disappoint you, Marshal.
Why would it disappoint me? It's none of my business.
No, not officially, of course. But I imagine you did hold a certain personal opinion.
Yeah. I still do, as a matter of fact.
Indeed. Such as?
Such as I think you're making a big mistake taking that girl back against her will.
Oh, I assure you I am using no straitjacket or manacles.
It amounts to that, though. Why don't you give her a chance, Mr. Taggart? You can get her out of Dodge if you want, away from what she's been doing, but why don't you let her live her own life?
She will live precisely as I tell her to live, Marshal.
Won't work that way, Mr. Taggart. You can't treat people like horses. You can't own people.
Marshal, I've built an empire on the principle of owning people. I own hundreds of them, body and soul, lock, stock, and barrel. I call the tune, and they dance, and she will dance with me.
You ready, Father?
Quite ready, my dear.
Then let's go.
Good day, gentlemen.
Goodbye, Evie. Good luck.
Thank you, Marshal. But I think we may meet again soon.
Come along, Evie.
Yes, Father.
Oh, just look you there. Just look how he's broke her spirit, Miss Young. She's going along meek to the line.
Yeah, it looks that way. Now, what's he doing here?
That's Bill Jacks.
I want to talk with you, Taggart.
Come on, Chester.
Look here, Jacks. There's nothing for us to talk about.
All right, hold it, Jacks.
I'll stay out of this.
What are you looking
for? Don't try it, Jacks. You drop your gun or I'll fire. Now, drop it!
You got him, Mr. Dillon?
Your father's dead, too, Evie.
Father.
So this is how he was supposed to pay, huh?
I don't know what you mean, Marshal. Bobby had a disagreement over the price on Burl's head.
What price did you put on your father's head, Evie? How much were you going to pay Bill Jacks for this?
I can't prove a thing, Marshal. Not a thing.
Well, we'll let the judge decide that.
I don't care. As long as he finally lost.
What?
Father. Sure doesn't own anybody now, does he?
Les Crutchfield's script, Tag, You're It, originally heard October the 5th, 1958. Rex Corey was Gunsmoke's musical director. Corey entered radio in the 1930s, and his music has been heard on every major radio and TV network since then. Today, Rex is delighting theater audiences around the country with his pipe organ accompaniment for silent films. Corey is especially proud of the work he and his musicians performed on Gunsmoke, and he vividly recalls the first broadcast.
I remember that when we started the music on Gunsmoke, the very initial broadcast, we used a larger orchestra. In fact, the theme material, opening and closing, was recorded with a larger orchestra, and we continued to use that larger sound to give it a bigger and more impressive opening and closing. Then we went into what we called our standard, I think, 6 or 7 piece combo that we used, which, not so much in the interest of economy, but for the specific sound that we wanted to acquire. We felt that a large orchestra was out of place with the time, the tempo. It didn't do the job for us. Whereas a small group, which included accordion, some harmonica, guitar, timpani effects, that sort of thing, were much more practical and aesthetically correct for the stories and the people involved.
In the smaller orchestra, Rex played the T accordion while he conducted.
Now, this was not the standard accordion that you strap on yourself. This was an electric T accordion, as we called it, which stood on its own standard, and you could regulate the volume from a pedal control. And the nice thing about it was that you could play both hands on the treble portion if you wanted to, or use the buttons or whatever. It was very flexible.
Announcer George Walsh has his own recollections of Corey's T accordion.
When they changed the orchestra from the full size that was probably 20 pieces, it became a much smaller group, and Rex changed. With the big orchestra, he played the organ, the pipe organ, and he used to conduct from the organ bench with body English. Well, when they cut down on the size of the orchestra, he went from the organ to an accordion. He had an electric accordion built. I don't know whether this was his invention or not, but I had never seen one like it before. He didn't have to pump the bellows by hand. It became a T-shaped affair with an upright and then the accordion in two sections across the top, forming the T, so that with his right hand he'd play the keyboard, and then with his left hand he'd play the buttons, and then with his foot, he had a control of a pedal that gave him air pressure and so forth. It was quite a strange looking... Of course, Bill Conrad didn't have much respect for it. He referred to it as Rex Corey's electronic urinal.
I think that Bill set the tone and the pace for Jim Arness, who later followed. Now, of course, they're two different people and two different talents. But Bill had that a great ability to establish a character in your mind, to set an image. And Bill, being the type of performer he was, with such a wide range of capability, was perfect for the part of Matt Dillon, because Matt Dillon had to be a man who could be tough and who could be very sensitive at the same time. Bill had a very virile, manly voice, low-pitched. He could be very positive in his speech. He could be very tough and hard, and he could be very, very soft and sentimental. In approaching the music for the show and realizing that Bill was a central character who set the whole pace and tempo, I had to consider music that would be fitting and proper for this rather complex person. This meant that the music had to be coarse and rough and tough, and it also had to be very tender and touching.
Well, what can we do now, Della, to help you?
Boy. Buried Jed right here. Right here. He'd like that. It's about as far west as he'll ever get. No.
Gave me a wide scope in which to operate musically, and it put demands on the musicians we had, because we had to produce tonal effects to suit the situation. And again, it became a wonderful challenge because you had such a wide latitude in which to work.
Many of the scenes in Gunsmoke took place in the Long Branch Saloon, and to provide just the right atmosphere, a barroom piano was necessary. Corey recalls how he first created that realistic sound.
We had to establish the very first scene in the Long Branch, and we had to establish the fact that there were all sorts of coarse Western characters involved, that there were dancing girls and various degrees of activity. And the music had to be something that would set the scene and yet be just a part of it. Nobody really knew what they wanted, I don't think. But I went over to the piano and I started messing around with it during rehearsal. Norman said, "Hey, that's good." He said, "What can we do to make it a little more tinny?" So we did the quickest thing we could do, and that was to get a whole bunch of paper clips and string them together and lay them over the strings. We later refined that by getting an old beat-up upright piano and putting thumbtacks in all the hammers so that we got a real honky-tonk sound out of it. And I also had to think about the type of melody that would have been popular at that time and still not come up with a recognizable piece of music. So it was always kind of improvised in the spot in a real sort of an early 19th century Western barroom style of composition. It got to be a thing where we would do things on the piano just for the entertainment of the cast, even during the broadcast, because extemporaneous noise and laughter was all to the good anyway. And I found that I was having a lot of fun being inventive and trying to get reaction out of the cast by for the type of music I played. My goodness. Quite a crowd in the little long bench tonight.
Over here, Matt. Come on over here and join us.
There's Doc, Mr. Butt. Can you want to join him, Mr.?
Yeah, might as well. Oh, would you pardon me, please?
Hello, Matt. Good to see you.
Hello, Kitty.
Can I get you something?
Yes, as a matter of fact, you can. The usual, if you don't mind.
The same for me, Miss Kitty. We'll be over at the table after dark.
All right, fine. I'll join you.
Good.
Pull up a chair, Matt. Winchester. Join us solid, respectable citizens for a change.
Well, there's some who would agree with you, Doc. How are you, Stockton?
Hi, Marshal. Can I buy you a drink?
Well, I got one coming, thanks. Oh, I just saw Miss Gross outside. She tells me she's going back east.
Well, I can't say I'm sorry to hear it. For some reason, she seems to blame me for what her son did.
Yeah.
Most of us felt that we would make the transition normally and naturally. Certainly in my particular experience, that was the way it worked. I knew that I was going to make the transition. In fact, I was already making the transition. We were doing radio and television shows at the same time. With the particular cast of Gunsmoke, the blow was a very hurting one for those involved when CBS decided to go ahead and produce it as a television show. It was a big disappointment. They had figured, I'm sure, that they would go ahead and work into the television aspect. And the whole accent was on the television series. The musical direction for it had passed into the hands of the man who was then, Mr. Gluskin, who was then the musical director for the CBS network on the West Coast. He had gotten full control of the situation, and I did some composition here and there. And on top of that, some of the radio music has been carried over and used into the television series as such. When the show went to an hour-long production, why, it was obvious that one composer couldn't begin to handle it all anyway. So there have been various writers along over the years that have contributed to the music that has been used on Gunsmoke.
In 1957, the radio show was dealt two severe blows. First, Liggett and Myers dropped full sponsorship of the series. This led CBS to offer the program to participating advertisers. Complicating matters was the poor economic health of network radio in general. Thanks to television, advertisers were becoming reluctant to sink huge sums of money into a medium that supposedly had a dwindling audience. As a result, the network was finding it increasingly difficult to sell all the commercial time available. Public service announcements and promos started to fill the slots where only months ago, announcers George Fenneman and George Walsh extolled the delights of smoking L&M cigarettes. The second serious blow to the radio program was the loss of the live orchestra, recounted by Rex Corey.
For economic reasons, it had been discovered that live orchestras might not be all that necessary. Now, this unfortunately was triggered by a rather tragic and ill-timed musician strike called by the AFMM, the American Federation of Musicians, at a time when I suppose the timing was right for experimentation with recorded cues and bridges and backgrounds. I say it was ill-timed because it taught the producers and the networks that they could get along without live music. Not only did it hurt the professional musicians who were involved on many of these broadcasts, but it damaged the caliber of music, because instead of having music specifically designed for a given situation or a given performance, they were picking up on a hit-or-miss basis recorded music of various sorts, imported from various parts of the world, with various combinations, and so much of the music didn't fit. And unfortunately, our listening public has become conditioned to poor music in much of our drama today, in television and in many other uses, because of this.
And Gunsmoke started on the air in 52, as we've mentioned, and network radio was beginning to die just at the time we were starting. I guess what I mean is that in those early days, if you were doing a series and the series was canceled, something else popped up and you were told to start preparing for a show called such and such, which would go on the air next Tuesday. There was always something to replace the show that went off the air. By the end of the 50s, and certainly by the 60s, when a show went off the air, that was just the end of that half hour or that 2 hour segment, and it was filled with something else. And that something else usually came from New York. It was a sad period for those of us who were fond of radio and enjoyed radio, and indeed had been brought up in radio. And it was not, believe me, a matter of sour grapes, because all of us who were then working on the radio show were also busy and gainfully employed on the television show or some other television show. Bill Conrad was producing and directing in television. Later he became an executive at Warner Brothers. At the same time, John Meston was writing, I think he wrote as many as 40 half-hour television episodes in 1 year. He was also writing regularly, when it went to an hour, the television version, some 12 to 15 episodes a year. So we were all busy. But it was really the fact that dramatic radio from the West Coast was drying up. Gunsmoke passed away, if you will, just at a time when there were new kinds of audio equipment coming on the scene that would have made it marvelous. For instance, if Gunsmoke had been done in stereo or quadraphonic, if you can picture Matt's horse coming down Front Street, the whole length of it, passing from one side of your living room to the other, just as it passed from one end of Dodge to the other, or Matt's booted feet working their way all the way across the street and up the steps and into Doc's office on the second floor. It would have been rather wonderful to hear this, but radio was already on its way out then.
As a footnote, Gunsmoke had the dubious distinction of being the last network dramatic program to originate in Hollywood. During the program's final 4 years, scripts were authored by such top Western writers as Kathleen Height, John Dunkel, Les Crutchfield, and Marion Clark. Their scripts were often alternated with some of John Meston's better offerings from previous years. Even some members of the Gunsmoke Company became authors. Director Norman McDonald wrote numerous programs. Supporting player Vic Perrin contributed several scripts. And soundman Tom Hanley authored a hilarious story entitled Marshall Proudfoot. This program centered around Chester's father paying a surprise visit to Dodge. Parley Bear doubled his role, playing both Chester and his dad. Here's Marshall Proudfoot, as it was heard on July 20th, 1958.
There, Matt. You here?
Yeah, I'm here, Doc. Come on in.
Oh, well, how come you're in bed so early?
I'm not in bed, Doc. I'm just resting.
Oh, I see the cost of government's going up again.
Oh? What makes you say that?
The soles of your boots. They're worn almost through.
I don't care.
What's the matter? Aren't you feeling good?
Sure, I feel fine, Doc. I always lie in bed till noon.
Uh-huh, well, it just doesn't look right for you to be... Oh, for heaven's sake.
What's the matter now?
It's cold. The coffee's cold in the rattlesnake's belly.
Don't drink it, sir.
And it's no better hot here. No, Matt, like I was saying, a man in your position should have more to do than just lie around.
Well, maybe I'm just tired, Doc.
Oh, now, don't try to tell me it was brought on by upholding law and order all night, because I don't want to hear about it. I had a bad night myself.
Well, then sit down and rest.
Yes, here you go. Aren't you going to ask me what I was doing?
No.
No. Well, I spent the whole night working for $4 fee.
Oh? Well, it must have been somebody who didn't know you.
Then. They knew me, yes. It was Jeb Dorn. His wife had a baby girl.
Jeb, huh?
He was hoping for a boy, as I recall it.
And that's what it was.
Oh, why?
He refused to pay me.
No wonder you're tired.
What's it thing here? Well, who's this poster on?
It says right there, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Wanted, dead or alive, Jack Pargo for the torture and subsequent murder of... this man is noted for armed holdup and is believed heading in the general direction of Missouri, Kansas, or Nebraska. He's a mean-looking devil, isn't he? Well, I can see that he'll certainly find his comeuppance if he sticks his head in Dodge City.
Well, I'll tell you, Doc, I'll worry about that if he comes here.
Oh, well, that gives me a nice, safe feeling.
Marshal, here is he.
Yeah, I'm a marshal.
I say, Marshal Proudfoot, hereabouts is he.
Marshal Proudfoot?
Huh? I'll say neither one of you ain't the marshal, I can tell. I'm his paw, I'd know him anywhere.
Doc, go find Chester, will you?
Sure, Matt.
No need to get up. Just come see my boy, Marshal Chester Proudfoot. Made good somehow, he did. Chester never was one of my brightest boys. 11 boys I had, I remember. Say, I ain't shook hand here yet. What's your name, sonny?
Dillon, Matt Dillon.
Dillon? That's a funny name for a man. I knew a man one time had the name of Hargrove. I thought that was the funniest up till now, but
Doc, you better go get Chester.
Who's that fella?
Well, that's Doc Adams.
Nice to know you, sir.
Saying something, is he?
I said it's nice
now,
to know.
My name is Wesley Proudfoot. Sired a marshal, turns out. Yes, sir. 11 boys I had. Chester was nowhere near the brightest. No, sir, he'd rate about number 9 there.
Well, that's very interesting, Mr.
Chester,
Proudfoot.
Chester bordered on being ignorant, I think.
Oh, now,
I can't imagine how he ever got to be a marshal. Chester Wesley Proudfoot, marshal of Dodge City.
Look, Mr. Proudfoot.
They named all them boys with the middle name of Wesley after me, it did. Hoped at least one of them would mount something like me. What's his name was?
It's Adams. Dr. Adams.
Dr. Adams. Horse or people?
What?
What's the matter, Hugh? I say, do you doctor horses or people?
People.
Oh, well, it's too bad for you. I wouldn't ever let a people doctor work on me, and I got a great many things wrong with me, too. Hey, where's Chester?
He's out getting the mail for me.
Well, good for him. Got spunk. Probably running down some of them bad men he always writes about. Used to have an assistant named Dillon working for him. Whatever become of him?
Dillon, that's me, Mr. Potfoot. Matt Dillon, that's me.
Oh, yeah. Well, you'll do a fair job, Gordon Chester. Says he can usually depend on you.
Well, that's very nice of him. Look, Mr. Proudfoot, maybe you should know something.
Hello, Doc.
Chester?
There wasn't none too much mail, Mr. John.
Forget it, Chester.
What?
Chester, you've got company.
Who's a fat fella?
That's Chester. That's the Marshal Proudfoot.
Paul, Mr. Dillon, Paul,
that's you, Chester?
Yeah, that's him, Mr. Proudfoot.
Ah, you've fatted up a good deal, Chester. Your assistant here looks better than you do. I'd like an explanation.
Matter of fact, so would I, Chester.
Mr. Dillon, Doc, Paul.
What are you going to do about Matt?
Do about what, Doc?
Chester, telling his father that he's the marshal.
What can I do?
Well, not going to let him get by with it, are you?
Oh, I don't know, Doc.
Wait a minute, Matt. No. Let me by.
Oh?
An assistant doesn't make too much, you know.
Easy, Doc.
Hello, Doc.
Matt.
Oh, Kitty.
Doc, you're looking pretty strange today. How come?
tell her, Nat.
You tell her, Doc. You're the one looking strange.
Well, come on. Somebody tell me.
Yeah. Sit down. Thank you. Thank you.
Have you seen Chester, Kitty?
No. Why?
Well, we may never see him again.
What? What happened?
Not much, really, but I'm sure he wishes he was dead right now.
Oh, what's this all about?
Chester's father came to town today.
Well, what's so terrible about that?
That's a tip. He thinks Chester is the marshal here.
What?
Yeah, that's right, Kitty. Chester wrote to his father, and he probably stretched the truth a little bit, like we all do sometimes.
Oh, no. Well, where are they now?
Over at the Dodge House. He's getting the old man a room there.
Yeah, I never saw Chester look so scared in my life, Kitty. You should have seen him. He grabbed his paw and he lit out of the office like his coat was on fire.
Don't be hard on him now.
I'm not going to be hard on him.
Well, his father must be pretty old.
Oh, he's old, all right, yeah. He can't hear good and he can hardly see. But he's a bright old fellow.
Well, you can't let the old man be disappointed, Matt.
Well, what would you suggest I do, Kitty?
I don't know. Just don't hurt him, that's all.
I'm not gonna hurt him, Kitty. I don't care if the old man thinks Chester's a marshal.
Matt, we should think of something to make Chester look good while his father's in town.
Yeah. I heard the old man tell Chester that he was only gonna stay for a few days. Oh, say, Matt. Now, maybe you could lie low for a while.
I wouldn't mind that. I need a rest.
Hey, I got it. Why don't you get somebody to pretend to hold up and then let Chester play marshal and take him in? You can turn him loose when his father leaves.
Oh, no, Kitty, I couldn't do a thing like that.
Well, something's got to be done, Matt.
Yeah, did you? I could put you to bed, Matt.
What are you talking about, Doc?
Yeah, you get sick and I'll examine you and say that you've got a rare blood disease and you have to go to bed for a few days.
It might work, Matt. I can't let that old man go away thinking Chester's been lying to him all this time.
No. We'll get Moss Grinnett to stage a fake holdup, you see? Then we'll come and get Chester, and right in front of his father, he'll capture the bandit.
You're the one with a rare disease, Doc, and it's not in your blood, it's in your brain.
I'll do it, Matt. You got to.
No, I don't got to. I don't want any part of a fake holdup. You just get that out of your head.
Oh, Matt.
Well, I'm going back to the office.
Oh, sure, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. Ruin an old man in his last days.
What do you think, Doc?
Ed, I... Old Matt'll come around all right, Kitty. He always does. I'll go talk to Moss Grimmick and have it all set.
Anybody here? I say anybody in here? Or they... Oh, there you are, Dillon. Well, took your bed kind of early, didn't you? Ain't but 4 o'clock.
Hello, Mr. Proudfoot. Where's Chester?
Yes. Well, I guess you got such a dead little town on your hand, you can do that, you and Chester.
I say, where is Chester?
Saying something?
I said, where's Chester?
Don't yell like that. Hurts my ear pans when you beller out like that. Got a pretty big voice on you there, Dillon. What's the matter with you? Feeling poorly, are you? I say, feeling poorly, are you?
I feel terrible.
Too bad. Chester ain't feeling too good, neither.
Oh.
Oh, been lolling around on my bed over at the Rubin house all day. Good thing you boys got this dead town on your hands.
Yeah.
Yeah, people be up the creek with both the marshal and his sister in bed. Ooch over there. I say, ooch over there. Let me take a look at you. Let me look at your eyes. Tell everything about how a man feels by looking to his... Look at me, Dillon.
I can't help looking at you.
That's Mr. it. Dr. That's coming. Yes, sir. You've got bad eyes there, Dillon. That one in particular. You've got a good voice, but bad eyes. Them eyes reminds me of Chester's Uncle Hector. Last time he looked all slack-jawed like that, he died the next day. Huh? What say?
Nothing. I didn't say anything.
Oh, thought you talked. No. Yes, sir. Hector was Chester's fighting uncle. Reckon that's where Chester gets all his get up and go.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Well, some different, though. Hector fought again the law, Hector did. Ever seen a man stirred up again the law all the time like old Hector was?
Have you had your dinner yet, Mr. Proctor?
Oh, indeed. He was a winner. You're right there. Won all his battles. Killed 2 marshals, Hector did. Killed them dead. Good thing Chester's on the side of the law. Man, that's a pair like that ought to be on the side of the law.
Hey, Matt, you here?
Yes, you ought to be.
Hello, Mr. Thompson.
You what? Yeah. Oh, you're here. Yeah. Look here, you got a sick deputy here, Adams. Better go get a horse doctor and get him straightened out.
Oh. What are you doing in bed, Matt?
I'm in bed because I'm sick, Doc. Did you ever hear of anything like that?
You're sick?
Uh-huh.
You are, man? Oh, say, that's fine.
Yeah, well, I figured you'd think so. Doc, would you do me a favor and take Mr. Proudfoot out to dinner? Anything, just get him out of here.
Yeah, sure, Matt. You bet you... Oh, gee, your eyes look kind of beady there.
Yeah, well, we've been through all
that. Well, if I didn't know that, I'd say that you had a fever.
Adams, I say you got a sick boy there, Adams.
Doc, would you go right now?
Yeah, okay. Oh, sure. Mr. Proudfoot, you come with me, Mr. Proudfoot. I'll take you to dinner.
Yeah, dinner? No, too early for dinner. Take a little glass of Dutch water with you, though, but don't let on Chester, will you?
Yes, sir. I'll see you later, Matt, and... I'll let Kitty know you're with us.
Oh, fine, Doc. Good. Yeah. You let Kitty know I'm with you. Yes. Just go.
Yes, sir, Adams. That boy there is sicker than a pig.
Let Kitty know I'm with you.
Doc! Doc, you come back here!
Hey, Kitty.
Yeah.
Where's Doc?
I don't know, Matt. He was here a little while ago. Why?
I've wasted a half hour looking in all the Eden houses for him. He's got Chester's father with him. I got to stop him.
Stop him from what?
From that fool idea that you and he had.
What do you mean, fool idea? Doc came by and said it was on, that you were playing sick in bed.
Kitty, I was in bed because I really was sick, and I still am sick. Oh. Have you and Doc lost your senses?
Well, we're just trying to help Chester, that's all.
Now, look, what if somebody else sees that hold-up Moss Grimmick at stage, and how do they know that he's just playing games?
Huh? Doc and I aren't going to let anybody get hurt, Matt. And you know Chester, he'll play along all the way.
That's exactly what I'm afraid of.
Oh, Kitty! All set, Kitty. Oh, hello, Matt. Oh, you're on your feet for the firm.
You call this thing off right now, Doc.
Oh, no, it's too late, Matt. Chester and his father up at the Dodge House in exactly 3 minutes from now. Moss Grimmick is going to rush up there and say there's a hold up at the livery stable.
And I'm putting a stop to it before somebody gets...
What's that?
Oh, I don't know. It's not time yet.
Oh, come on, Doc. You can watch the fun you started.
Yes, come on.
You know, something ought to knock your head off.
No, Matt, no. Take it easy, Matt.
Marshal Dillon.
What?
You better hurry. Chester just shot a man at the Dodge House.
Good Lord.
Come on, let me through here, will you please? Move aside. Let me through.
Stand there. Matt, wait. Oh, look. Chester's sitting on somebody.
Chester, what are you doing? Get off of that man. Doc, check that one line over there.
Will you? I will.
Stand back. He shot and wounded one fellow, and we subdued the other one.
All right, Mr.
Jim Cole, we did. Ain't a bad night's work, is it?
No, Chester, will you get up?
Well, Mr. Dillon, he tried to kill me and Paul.
Get up, I said. He's unconscious.
Oh, Matt, wait a minute. Look here.
What is it, Doc?
Look at this man. It's Jack Pargo.
What?
You know the man on that wanted poster?
Yeah, that is Pargo, all right.
Matter, Dillon? That fellow friend of yours, is he? He tried to hold up the hotel office here.
No, Mr. Proudfoot, it's not a friend of mine.
Huh? What say? Or anybody catch that car, man?
Hey, Chester! Chester! Hurry up, Chester. There's a hold up at the livery stable.
Moss, go home.
Yeah, but Doc told me that.
Just go back to your livery stable and call off the hold up, huh?
Yeah, forget it, Moss. Forget it. We've had the real thing, right?
Well.
Goodbye, Moss.
Well, yeah, sure. Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Yes, goodbye. Goodbye.
Now, Fuller, come here.
Notice something here, did you, Dillon? Chester was right on the spot, he was. That's the reason he took my bed for so long.
Uh-huh.
He got an instinct for these things, Chester has. Put him right here on the spot for this holdup.
Now,
there's a reason for everything, I always say,
yeah,
Dillon.
Yeah, well, there's a reason, all right.
What say, Dillon?
Mr. Dillon, I can explain all this.
No, Chester, you and your father take care of things here. I'm sick and I'm going to bed.
Don't count on me taking care of things, Dillon. I'm leaving on morning stage. Now I'll saw my boy in action.
Yeah, well, all right, Mr. Proudfoot. Goodbye and good luck to you.
You wait right here a minute, Bob. Mr. Dillon?
Yeah, what?
Mr. Dillon,
Mr. Dillon, I can explain.
You don't have to, Chester.
But, yes, sir, I do have to explain. I swear I've never been so humiliated in all my whole life. I've been thinking about it all day, Mr. Dillon. I never wrote but two letters to Pa, and... Well, maybe I did stretch a couple things, but Pa, he put it all together and made me out more important than what I am. But I'll set him straight, Mr. Dillon, honest. I will. I'll tell him the truth, and I'll do it right now.
Chester. You do, and you're fired. You go on back and help your father take care of things.
Yes, sir, Mr. Dillon.
Marshall Proudfoot, written by sound man Tom Hanley.
Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed this episode of OTRWesterns.com. Like and rate it in iTunes, OTRWesterns.com/iTunes. Follow us on Facebook, OTRWesterns.com/Facebook. And send me an email, podcast@OTRWesterns.com. This episode is copyright under the attribution, non-commercial, share-alike copyright. For more information, go to OTRWesterns.com/copyright. Have a great day, and again, thanks for listening.